Roy Reed, a retired University of Arkansas journalism professor and New York Times reporter, is characterized in the new Academy Award-nominated feature film Selma. Directed by documentary producer Ava DuVernay, the movie chronicles embattled African-American protests staged in Alabama in the spring of 1965, which eventually led to passage of a federal Voting Rights Act. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, Roy Reed was witness to that history.
Roy Reed is among a small stable of noted 20th century Arkansas reporters. And lucky for us, the 85-year-old Hawkeye resident continues to write. His latest is a memoir titled Beware of Limbo Dancers, a correspondent's adventures with the New York Times. After a decade reporting for the Arkansas Gazette in Little Rock in the late 50s and early 60s, a friend carved out a place for him at the nation's most prestigious newspaper.
The Times had a Southern correspondent in those years named Claude Sitton. He had been promoted to national editor, so he hired me as the first person on his national staff.
One of Reed's first assignments was covering ongoing civil rights demonstrations in 1965 being staged by several associations of nonviolent African-American activists in Selma, Alabama, led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The campaign culminated in a freedom march that would start at the Edmund Pettus Bridge and end at the state capitol in Montgomery on March 7th. Dr. King was absent that day, so standing in for him was Hosea Williams with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and 23-year-old John Lewis, then head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Today, of course, he's known as U.S. Congressman John Lewis. The press was sequestered at a far spot on the bridge, and heavily armed and masked law enforcement had gathered.
We were lined up on the shoulder of the highway on the Montgomery side of Edmund Pettus Bridge. When the virtually all-black march got to that end of the Pettus Bridge, their way was blocked by 242 forces. First, state troopers under the command of George Wallace's head of the state police, Colonel Al Lingo, L-I-N-G-O, Lingo. And also, I mean, they were aided by men on horseback who were sort of irregulars working for the county sheriff's department. And the county sheriff at that time was Jim Clark. And he called these horseback riders his posse. The state police were armed with billy clubs, and the horseback riders used horse whips. The reporters were off on the shoulders. There were television cameramen positioned to capture it all, which they did. The state troopers ordered the marchers to stop, and somebody in the march, not Martin Luther King, he was not there, but one of his lieutenants, named Hosea Williams, along with the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, John Lewis, and a couple of other people were in the front row, and one of them said to the officers that may we have a moment to pray, and they kneeled. And before they could get an answer, before anybody said anything from the state trooper side, Colonel Lingo gave the order to start, meaning put on your gas masks and then move ahead to break up this, as he called it, an illegal march. The tear gas spread over the marchers, the newsmen, everybody who didn't have a gas mask who was in the area. The gas was awful. I do remember that. It hurts like the dickens. But the marchers got the worst of it, which was by design. I'm sure that Colonel Lingo was well satisfied that a lot of us out-of-town newsmen got a dose of it as well. But he was mainly aiming to subdue, not just subdue, but punish, hurt these marchers. They swept ahead and ran over the marchers with their billy clubs flying, and the men on horseback waded in with their horse whips, whipping people. I remember seeing a middle-aged woman named Amelia Boynton unconscious on the ground, and lying beside her was young John Lewis of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, seriously injured. It turned out when they got him to the hospital, he had a cracked skull. The troopers and the posse on horseback pursued these marchers back across Pettus Bridge, whipping them, beating them every step of the way. And of course the marchers fled in a panic and made their way back to the church. And that evening, on the evening news, they managed to get their film footage. And in those days, nothing was simple in television. They had to fly this footage to Atlanta to get it processed and got on the air. Everything was harder back then, but they managed to get it done. And when people around the United States saw that brutality at work in Selma, Alabama, the whole country kind of rose up in righteous rage. And I think that was the beginning of the end of the segregationist movement. It took years to play out, but that was a turning point.
Reed filed his coverage of what would become known as Bloody Sunday to the New York Times from the Albert Hotel in downtown Selma, where he had a room. At the time, reporters had to dictate handwritten or typed copy to Bureau audio recordists for stenographers to transcribe for copy editing.
And, you know, my story was on the front page the next day, as it well might have been, but it was not my story that turned the country around. It was those television images.
But Roy Reed's reporting on Selma became historical record and is often cited by scholars and writers. Even as he was covering the unfolding events, he knew he was witness to history.
Absolutely. It was obvious from the first moment. I had been in Selma for a month, a little over a month at that time, and had gotten the feel of this thing and knew the tension that was building up. The movement in Selma had been entirely run by the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. They were younger and maybe a little more impulsive, but they had got the movement going, working in churches and with school children and getting young people especially aroused about discrimination, and especially in regard to voting rights in Alabama. They had a ludicrous voting a literacy test that a person had to pass in order to get to register to vote. And it was just preposterous. And it was administered, of course, by white officials. And if a white person came in to register, they just stamped it and passed, you know. But if a black person came in, he or she was subjected to all kinds of impossible questions and then marked rejected. So I can't begin to remember the figures, but a preposterously low number of black people were registered to vote in that county, Dallas County, Selma. And that's what this campaign was all about, was to get people to overturn that law or get federal help or whatever it took to make it possible for black eligible voters to be able to vote.
Roy Reed was also eyewitness to a disturbing sidebar event. A large group of black children caught up in the campaign's fever ended up being horribly wrangled by Dallas County Sheriff Jim Clark and his posse. Reading from his memoir,
about 100 of the kids, thinking to get in on the movement that was the talk of their part of town, decided to hold a march of their own. The sheriff obliged them by leading them himself in his official car. He led them right out of town and several miles down a country road, moving at a brisk pace. I followed the procession in a rental car. When the smaller kids couldn't keep up, deputies shocked them with cattle prods. The kids finally swarmed into somebody's yard and lay panting and crying, some vomiting, while the sheriff and his men drove away laughing. I was close to vomiting myself as I drove back to town and phoned in my story.
After a federal district court judge issued a restraining order, a second march failed to fully deploy. President Johnson, who by that point was promising to introduce voting rights legislation to Congress, was also pressuring Dr. King to delay further action until he could dispatch federal troops to protect them. A federally sanctioned march finally succeeded later that month, led by Dr. King, across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, 50 miles to Montgomery, where protesters planned to confront Alabama Governor George Wallace, an outspoken segregationist, to demand restrictive voting rights practices be abolished. On August 6th, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. Documentaries, articles, and books about the Selma Bridge campaigns are plentiful, but the 2014 motion picture Selma, newly released, directed by Ava DuVernay, is the first ever feature film.
We must march! We must stand up!
You march those people into rural Alabama, it's got to be open season.
May I have a word?
There's no word to be had.
The people! The people. The people. The people.
And Roy Reed, who's characterized in the movie, had no idea he was in it until he was contacted by Paramount Pictures in December.
It was a nice young woman who arranged, who said, "Would you like to see this movie?" And at first I said, "Well, not necessarily. I got things going on." But she was insistent, and I finally decided, "Well, it would be fun." So she said, "Well, when's a good time for you?" And it finally set up, bring some friends, you know, family, whoever you want. So they got the Malco Theater in Fayetteville to give us a private screening.
The movie, he said, brought the experience back to life.
The episode at the foot of Edmund Pettus Bridge on March 7th, 1965. That part was done terrifically. I felt as if I was back there. I could almost feel the tear gas and hear the billy clubs thumping on people's heads. Very well done.
But Reed says he has strong reservations about how President Johnson is portrayed in DuVernay's film as an obstructionist to King's voting rights agenda. You see, 2 years after covering Selma, Roy Reed was assigned to the Times White House News Bureau in 1967, where he covered Johnson's administration.
It's not that he was opposed to voting rights. He thought the timing was not right because he was, at the same time, he was pushing his war on poverty. He had a bunch of bills in the pipeline that he wanted passed. He was afraid that this would be a distraction, voting rights would be a distraction. But Dr. King took the opposing view that nothing is more important in the southern states than voting rights. And he took it on himself to force the issue. President Johnson, who was probably the best politician I've ever known anywhere, understood clearly that in order to get anything through Congress, you have to let pressure build up. And then eventually, with enough pressure, Congress will pass whatever the bill is. Dr. King provided the pressure. Dr. King and hundreds and hundreds of other people, large numbers of black people from not just Alabama, all over, large numbers of white people who joined the march to Montgomery. But that vicious, that brutal attack at the foot of Pettus Bridge on that Sunday, was a tipping point. And that in itself provided a lot of pressure. And that built up very quickly, so that before the summer was over, the voting rights bill passed overwhelmingly. And President Johnson was able to say on a nationally televised address, he wound up that great speech. The last line was, "And we shall overcome."
In the movie, by the way, Roy Reed was played by actor John Lavelle.
He did a great job. I wish I had ever been that good looking, but there you are.
Roy Reed, who went on to work as an international correspondent for the New York Times before retiring in 1978 to teach journalism at the University of Arkansas and homestead in Hawkeye, has a framed yellowed UPI telephoto clipping hanging in his office, tracing back to Selma. It shows Reed covering a press conference a month before Bloody Sunday, standing just a few feet away from an exhausted Dr. Martin Luther King, just released from Selma City Jail. King's jailer, Public Safety Director Wilson Baker, can be seen in the background waving and ordering the newsmen to disperse. Roy Reed is standing his ground, eyes cast downward, carefully listening, taking notes. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can see the photograph of Roy Reed with Dr. King on our website. On the post that accompanies Jacqueline's story, and more details of Roy Reed's Selma coverage can be found in his memoir, Beware of Limbo Dancers, A Correspondent's Adventures with the New York Times. It's published by the University of Arkansas Press.